Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of this is available as open source, and they also have a hosted commercial version too. You can check all of this out at influxdata.com.
So hi folks, my name is Mike Julian, and I'm here with Steve Mushrow, CEO of ChinaNet Cloud, and his new startup, Siglos. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you, glad to be here.
So you and I met through Monitoring Weekly some time ago, and we've just been chatting since then and learning all about, or me learning primarily about the wild world of systems in China. I believe the company you run, ChinaNet Cloud, is one of the largest, if not the largest, Chinese AWS partner.
Probably. We're the first one. We were their first sort of operations partner here in China, and also their first MSP, or managed service provider partner. So we've been on AWS here and around the world almost 10 years. So it's been an interesting time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So why don't you tell us a bit more about what your company does? Like, what are you doing in the Chinese market?
So here in China, we're basically a managed service provider. And so we started 10 years ago now, really managing systems, because I was CTO for Tudou, similar to YouTube in the US. So online video and so on, actually older and bigger than YouTube. And so we saw how the market really needed operations help. So we really launched this to start helping people design, build, operate, manage, monitor, all that sort of stuff. Internet systems, this is before the clouds and all that. And then we were the first cloud company in China, actually doing online VM, so you could buy actual virtual servers. Now, of course, you have AWS and Alibaba and others doing that. And so today our job is really then just design, build, manage, monitor, troubleshoot, and do 7x24 support for large-scale internet systems. So we're right in the way in the back end, you might say, but really sort of ditch digging operations guys and girls, really dealing with just 24-hour systems and clouds and hybrids and all the interesting problems you can have with, especially with Chinese scale.
So I think it's what we do. I think it's absolutely wild that there's to think about the size of YouTube. Like, pretty much everyone in the Western world thinks about YouTube and it's like, oh wow, that's absolutely huge. But to think of that there's a competitor in China that's bigger than that, the scale is staggering.
Yeah, I think now YouTube is larger, but back, this is 10 years ago now.
Oh, okay.
It was different because YouTube, even now in the US, think of it more like Netflix and YouTube combined, because YouTube historically has been short video clips, right? And 10 years ago was, hey, my cat is cute, stuff like this, 90 seconds, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. We were running full-length movies and TV and all that, not entirely legally, you might say. And so it was more like Netflix. So, we had 100 million viewers a day doing, sort of full-length stuff. So YouTube's average thing was whatever, a couple minutes. Ours was an hour. So completely different infrastructure needs. And this is before, especially China had good internet infrastructure and BGP routing and all kinds of stuff. So you had sort of massive CDN problems and lots of other stuff. I think we were the world's biggest bandwidth buyer for a while.
Oh, wow.
And now everybody else is bigger, but this was, again, a long time ago.
Sure.
Because DSL had just hit China, and everybody kind of wanted to watch Western movies and TV, and a lot of times had nothing else to do during the day, and so they're watching this everywhere, before smartphones, too. And so, so it was quite interesting. And actually, that company's older than YouTube, so even though, a lot of things come into China are sort of copies of Western things, those companies actually had much more features and much richer than YouTube and even Netflix today, 10 years ago. So more advanced, innovative, actually, than the Americans.
Right.
It it was pretty cool. And so we learned a lot about, you know, infrastructure here and the craziness of, you know, data centers and large scale systems, you know, thousands of servers and all kinds of locations, all this kind of stuff. And this is all physical servers, no virtualization, no nothing, right? This started in 2005. And I was here in 2007. And yeah, so it's, you know, hundreds of racks of equipment and all that kind of stuff. So
what's it like today? Like, so that's thinking back to what I was doing for systems in 2007, like, yeah, I was doing quite a bit of bare metal stuff. There was a little bit of virtualization in my world, but the scale wasn't even what you're talking about in then. So what's it like today? Is it just even more staggering scale? Is there a lot of cloud native stuff that's getting deployed, or are you still working on things that are like 10 years old by San Francisco Bay Area standards?
Well, it's all of those things. I think more broadly, the China market is of course, you know, it's some of the rest of the world. So we have a lot of clouds. We have AWS here, if you're not familiar, who's probably the number two or three player. We have Alibaba or AliCloud, also called AliYun, is the number one player by far, and also Tencent, kind of the other major player who makes WeChat and QQ and so on. But the cloud market in China is still quite small. It's only 1/10 of the rest of the world. And so even though it's, you know, pretty hot and people are doing stuff, and certainly anything new you would do on the internet, not unlike the Bay Area, would go on the cloud somewhere. You know, you wouldn't buy your own hardware for new things on the internet. There's a lot of legacy stuff, you know, probably still 95% of it is still, you know, traditional or beginning to think about hybrids and that kind of stuff. There's a huge tradition here of having your own hardware, having your own data centers, having your own equipment, almost where the U.S. was maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. And that's only slowly changing. In fact, everybody's rushing to do private virtual clouds here, say at VMware, of course. But even AliYun, and now I hear AWS, I think, just announced one also in the U.S., you know, these private systems where you can have all your own hardware, all your own data centers, but have the benefits of a cloud, that's going to be a huge thing in China because people just love to have that hardware and have their arms around it. They don't fully trust the cloud, just like, you know, AWS still isn't trusted fully,
right?
But they've made a lot of progress in that. That's still many, many years away here. So it's a mix. So we have about half our customers go on the cloud, whatever the cloud is, and half have physical servers, and some are doing hybrids. A lot of people want to move. You know, one of the problems, even globally, is there's not enough talent to help you move. You know, migration sounds easy, and it never is. And we do a lot of them, and it just takes real skill and real knowledge and real experience to migrate, you know, an old SAP system or web system or mobile or e-commerce or whatever. You know, it's always messy. It's always on physical servers. It's always, you know, 5-8-year-old software.
Yep.
And how do you move that? Right? We have a customer that I think they have 22-year-old Linux running.
Oh, wow.
It's Red Hat 6. Not Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6, but Red Hat 6.
Right. Been a while since I've seen that one.
It's on a 2.2 kernel. Yeah, it's on a 2.2 kernel. And that's just one of them. They have 6, they have 7, they have 8, then they have RHEL, RHEL,
yep.
I don't know what, 3, 4, 5. And I think I counted 22 different operating system versions there. But, you know, what do you do with that stuff? Okay, migrate that to the cloud. Well, you know, where do you even start with that, right?
Yeah.
This is a huge multi-billion dollar company. You can't just throw this stuff away, right? It runs important things. And so, and, you know, that's the enterprise world, and even in the U.S., and we do a bunch of that kind of stuff. So it's yeah, everybody's everywhere. I think people are getting to the cloud. You still do not see very much cloud native stuff. How would you define that? Of course, in the U.S., everybody talks about Kubernetes and all that. How many people are really running Kubernetes in production at scale, even in the U.S., is, you know, not nearly what you'd think. Here, you can probably count it on a few hands, especially at scale. And that's true of OpenStack also, and some of these more advanced systems. They're not there yet. Docker kind of floating around. We still don't see that much of it, really. And so everything is still pretty traditional. I'd say a good portion of our customers, most of them probably still FTP code to their servers. Maybe they do some Jenkins and some of that stuff, but it's still not that common. And yet it's at scale, right? So you have users with, you know, 100 million users, or customers 10, 100 million user systems, FTP, everything.
So,
off the developer's laptop.
Right. So for us that are steeped in, and I guess the Silicon Valley culture of how we do things, But to have even a few people FTPing code around is just, that's anathema to everything we do and think. To think of hundreds or thousands of people doing this as just standard practice, and to think about all the other practices and systems that go into deployment and security and monitoring and what that must mean if their deployment practice is FTP, like what does everything else look like? So that's,
well, it's crazy, a challenge. It's weird because, yeah, it's a little bit weird because in one level, it's like you said, it's let's call it behind or not up to what we might look at in the valley.
We'll call it less mature.
And the other level, let's call it less mature. On the other level, the head. So even when I was at Trudeau, you know, again, the video company 10 years ago, bare metal hardware, you know, 1,000 core servers and more around the world, we were deploying code, you know, every few hours on 100 different subsystems. Update every day.
I mean, that's
long before anybody was doing this.
That's
in the US, right?
That's, and so wild. I mean, there are companies that still don't do that.
Right, exactly. With all the automated tools, we had none of those tools. And so in one sense, it's behind because we don't have all the sexy tools, but the sort of dynamics of both Chinese internet and website in China in general, things just update and happen fast, right? So the idea of only update your website, you know, like NetSuite and Salesforce and people do every 6 months or every 3 months, it's for as long as I've been here, almost 15 years, it's been, you know, multiple times a day. And so in some sense, the culture has been very dynamic, extremely, let's call it DevOps-y, and extremely native in that sense and dynamic way before the US was, but without all the sexy tools. And so in some extent, that's just continued. So while the West has kind of gotten up to this multi-releases per day kind of thing and, you know, tooling and all of that, here it's kind of always been like that, just not as mature, you might say. So it's ahead and behind at the same time, if you know what I mean, but also very dynamic. So we have to deal with that where just, you know, this code pushes just all hours of the day, all versions of everything. And that's just sort of continued where I think in the West it sort of wasn't like that. And suddenly all these tools came and people started thinking about more dynamic pushes and dynamic code updates. And so we've had to deal with that forever, where even, you know, 10 years ago, customers are just deploying all the time, all hours of the day, breaking things all the time. How do you find that? How do you prove somebody did a deployment? How do you figure out they did? Because they'll say, oh, we didn't do anything. And you find out their third-party developer pushed something in at 9 p.m. So we have all these tools to track all this because in our world, we're sort of the exact opposite of I think, the way people think of cloud native now. You might say that the most modern way is, you know, infrastructure as code. Everything is in Git. Now it could be the hardware and the infrastructure is in Git also. My code's in Git. Everything's in Git. All my assets are in Git. Everything's there, right? So in theory, Git is the reference, right? It's the, mm-hmm. the gold standard or whatever.
It's the source of truth.
The source of truth, yes. That was what I was looking for. We have the exact opposite. Our source of truth is what's on the server running because it's the only thing we really can believe. And so we have lots of tools and technology to actually reverse engineer that. So we have deep CMDBs. We have config inspectors. We have command trackers. We figure out what actually happened. And we can diff, for example, all these production servers. You have 10 web servers and, you know, two of them aren't working the same way. Somebody's crashing and getting 500 errors. We can reverse engineer all the configs and all the pieces and parts and figure out why that is, because that's just reality for us. You might say from a cloud native side, well, just blow them away and just restart them and build them from.
Hey, yeah, exactly.
Master. We don't have a gold master. Right? So, you copy one from one of the others, right? And so we used to have tools. We could even do that. We could suck all the configs out of one server and build another one before you could do that on the cloud, you know? So. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's sort of developed its own culture of how do you be extremely dynamic and kind of messy and all that. You know, in China, things move fast and it scales. So it's the reverse of a bank or something like that, or very super structured, super formal processes are not that common.
Yeah. So it's almost like the Western culture and Chinese culture, as far as tech, came to the same conclusion of quickly updating dynamic infrastructure, but from two different premises, two different approaches. Whereas the U.S. Yeah. kind of started with how can we make this safe? China said this, we don't really care about safety as much because we just have to do it. We have to move this fast. And you've kind of created some sort of safety or some sort of introspection after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what we have done. And that's interesting now because we see, and of course, reality is it's all moving forward. And you do have more Jenkins and you have people more pushing formally and formal releases, and you're starting to get more Docker builds. You know, that stuff's starting to come in the more, let's call it the more advanced or the newer companies, of course, that have seen this or, you know, coming out of Google and other places. And but it's interesting for us because now we look to the West and some of the things there in the US and the people, things people are struggling with, which is how do I track all these moving parts and all that, you know, on the cloud and all that. And to us, this is old hat in a lot of ways because we've seen this movie before. Right. But people are still trying to deal with, oh my God, everything's changing all the time. We're like, yeah, we know everything's changing all the time. And so we're many generations into some of these things exactly for these reasons. And so, and I think reality is, of course, they're converging. Is that,
right.
You know, people, things aren't as formal as you really think in the US. But, you know, everyone says, never SSH into a server. You shouldn't even have it. It shouldn't be possible. Yet you go to conferences like Velocity. I was there last year in the Bay Area. And someone asked, you know, how many of you SSH into servers to fix stuff? And of course, every hand in the room goes up, right? And these are some of the largest operations folks in the world. And so it ain't as clean as people think it is. Yet they behave as if it is. We behave as if it's a complete mess at all times and you know, assume it's going to be like that, but yet try to work towards cleanliness and clean it up and rigor and all that, realizing it's imperfect. I think sometimes, especially in the Bay Area and cloud native folks and all that, you know, to assume everything's immutable and perfect all the time, then that, of course, gets them into a lot of trouble because it's not really. And so we live in that hybrid somewhere, which is cool.
That reminds me of a quote I read a while back, and I can't remember who it is, and of course, someone listening will figure it out for me. The quote says, "The only person in my life who behaves rationally is my tailor. He measures me every time I go to see him." Yeah, and yes. Like that's kind of how I feel about the DevOps and infrastructure and running systems at scale in the US is everyone talks about the what the idealistic perspective of like, oh yes, we never log into our servers, or we should never do it. And yet we all do it. We all do it daily, some more than that. So yes, while we shouldn't, we do. Whereas it sounds like in China, you say, well, no, like we clearly do. Like we're being honest with ourselves that this is what we do, but how can we make it better from there?
Absolutely. And even with that, we have to go a step further and track what other people are doing. So we actually have command trackers that when you SSH in, the shell sort of puts in some hooks and we get all the commands everyone runs, because you've got us as an outside third party, you've got the customer, let's say, you've often got third party developers, maybe more people, maybe other third party people, and everybody's not communicating, of course, or organized or documentation or anything, and they're changing stuff all the time. And so you really got to figure out what people actually did so you can point, not so much point the finger in a blaming way, but point the finger to, hey, you did this and what happened. And also, be able to go look deeply at configurations. So because people, you know, as of course people have discovered, as you, it's not just your infrastructure physically, it's the configurations of things matter a lot. Mm-hmm. Even if it's Nginx or PHP or Java or whatever, Ruby, so you've got to track that stuff. And near as we can tell, even in the West, people really aren't doing a good job of that.
Right.
You know, developers are picking off, Googling or downloading or finding simple Nginx configs, throwing those into production, not really understanding what they mean. That's another whole set of problems in operations. But then not really tracking changes to that and their effects, and then how they, you know, span across the fleet, right? And of course, everything's immutable and built from scratch every time. Okay, that's all right, but it often isn't that way, especially with databases and longer persisted, you know, virtual machines or containers or whatever. And so we have to actually be able to reverse engineer all that and say, you know, we've got these 9 Nginx servers. Something's wrong with Nginx 3. You know, what's wrong? Or questions like, we've got SSL bugs or SSL, you know, vulnerabilities. Which of our servers are running TLS 1.1, 1.2, and what ciphers? And near as we can tell, nobody in the world can tell that because they're just like, well, we don't care. We just push it all out there. But that reality is you have to know this stuff, right?
Yep.
So we have tools that can figure all that out for us so we can survey the whole fleet, you know, very quickly. Because, we've dealt with all this chaos for so long, we need to do these things. So it's very interesting. And, of course, it's at scale, you know, and so.
Right.
And now you're getting more hybrids and different things and, you know, and just like DevOps is still pretty new for a lot of people, even in the West, and then in a lot of these practices, you know, it's pretty new here too. So, you know, it's still an amalgamation. it's still an amalgamation of lots of different pieces and parts and technologies and hybrids and physicals and traditional things and new things and, you know, serverless, really not here yet, but serverless stuff is coming and Kubernetes and, you know, but SAP systems and, you know, now you've we got, you know, terabyte RAM databases running for SAP right alongside Docker containers serving, you know, mobile apps to register something. So it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So you and I have been talking about troubleshooting, and I think this maps well to what you're talking about, because how do you troubleshoot a system, like actually really troubleshoot it and understand what it's doing, when most people, how they approach troubleshooting is, I'm going to check this thing, I'm going to look over here, and like after a while, you just kind of start guessing about how your systems are working. So, for example, with your SSL thing, if you start having SSL negotiation problems intermittently, how do you even approach that? How do you know that, how do you even get to the SSL is your issue? What do you think about that? Are there any like standardized troubleshooting methods that you've seen work well with your own teams or with yourself?
Well, this is a very interesting area. I mean, in part because I grew up troubleshooting. I grew up in construction and factories and manufacturing. So I've been troubleshooting since I was, I don't know, 5 years old, you know. So I have to be careful because what comes natural to me and what I've been doing across lots of different industries is not always what everyone else is doing. And here it's different too, because it sort of highlights, again, things move very quickly and people want to get stuff done, want to fix stuff. And understanding how things work and how it's all put together is not that common. People just want to fix it, right? Like just start, get a hammer and just start redoing stuff and rebooting stuff and typing things, rather than stepping back, understanding how it works. And I think that's actually pretty common. And I suspect that DevOps, whatever that means, is making that worse also just more globally, because the reality is most developers don't know a lot about operations and vice versa. And then the systems at the same time getting more complicated and more pieces and more microservices and more going from, you know, complicated to complex and all these interactions, and nobody really knows how this stuff works unless you really have, you know, pretty senior folks involved with it. So in many ways, I suspect the West is becoming more like China, where it really don't understand all these parts are all moving around. And like you said, you just want to kind of bang on it a little bit and restart stuff and reboot stuff and kind of make it work.
Yep.
I've never seen a really good set of troubleshooting things. I've looked over the years. I recently wrote an article on a thing I gave at Lisa about sort of the Tao of troubleshooting, sort of 10 steps of that.
Yeah, and we'll throw that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, it's a little, it's kind of just a little bit cute of like, you know all the things and look at all the things. But
right.
The only ones I've seen, the only people who ever really attacked troubleshooting, you know, methodically, have been in the engineering disciplines, like, you know, nuclear reactors or military systems or communications, like the cell phone guys have a lot of stuff about this. Like, how do you troubleshoot a broken, not cell phone, but cell phone towers and infrastructure telcos, you know. But that stuff tends to be very academic and very, very hard to approach. And a lot of it was written in the 70s and stuff like this. So I've never seen more modern, like, this is how you go at approaching troubleshooting in the systems. And yet I think it's just very important about methodically going through things, understanding what it can be, very, very importantly, understanding what it can't be. We have endless engineers waste time Googling something and trying to solve problems they not only don't have, they can't have because of the way the system works, right? Google said, look at this, this, and this, but we don't actually have any of those things. And yet they'll spend a whole afternoon, you know, hunting that stuff down, right? Because they don't know they don't have it. Stuff like that. That's how do you teach them to, you know, step back? How do you step back and say, then when it all seems all messed up, you've got to step back and go, my assumptions are wrong. You know, something that I assume is true is not. You know, there's a famous, I think it's a Mark Twain quote. I think it's Mark Twain. I'm not sure who it is. You know, it's not the things that we know that cause us surprise. It's the things that we know that just aren't so, you know. And so it's the things that we think and we're sure that configuration says this. I'm sure I checked that file. I'm sure I just went and looked at this when actually you didn't. You looked at the wrong thing. You logged in the wrong server. You looked at some other wrong thing. And so something in your mental model is wrong. And one of the best ways to detect, you know, senior engineers and senior troubleshooting folks is, can they realize that? Can they step back and recheck all their assumptions, you know, after you've done this for a couple hours? Because something you've done is wrong enough. And you go, oh, yeah, that thing over there. And look at that. And of course, involving other people and communicating and all that. It's not just troubleshooting skill, of course. And let's talk about this. PagerDuty, I think, has done quite a bit of good work on this, on how do you manage incidents and how do you communicate and incident commanders and all that stuff. We actually created all that stuff like 7-8 years ago for our own needs. So it's interesting to see them and other people start to talk about incident management in the last 2 or 3 years, saying the same exact things. So that was pretty cool. So it's not only just troubleshooting itself, but it's all the things around it.
John Allspaugh has actually been talking a lot about this lately too. And you mentioned the checking of assumptions and how people think about troubleshooting. And in a talk he gave at PagerDuty Summit a while back, he showed this timeline of an incident. And at several points in this timeline, there was one engineer who said, "Hey, this problem feels like this, thing has happened," but they weren't able to say why. It just felt that way. And sure enough, it turns out that it was related to that thing, but it all came out of this engineer's instinct and a year old experience or several years old experience with one particular incident at some point in the past. So that particular incident informed their mental model of how the system worked and allowed them to have an instinctual response to this issue that they're seeing. The problem there is you can't really teach instincts. You can't teach experience. People are developed mental models by having more experience with the system. But then again, maybe you can. Maybe you can teach mental models. Have you had any success with trying to teach people how to do this?
Not a lot. and I agree. I mean, sure you can't teach. Well, here it's a little different because I think we're enmeshed in our case, sort of in the Chinese education system, which doesn't focus on that in a lot of ways. As you know, it's especially folks that tend to be our mid to senior folks that are a little bit older. Went to school here in the 70s, where the education was very focused on, as you know, sort of test taking and mathematics and study and these things, and sort of abstract mental models are not something you see a lot realistically in our workforce. And that's a problem. That's back to this: how do you understand how the whole system works, and then how do you troubleshoot and put it together? So I think that's an ongoing project. I would say in China and more broadly across Asia, that's a challenge, as you know, with education. And I think in the West, it's a little bit different, but the same thing. Yeah, you can't obviously teach all that experience. You can write it all down. But the mental model and the how you think about it and the intuition, I think you can try to teach, and or you can identify people that have it. It's like having the Jedi Force or having the Harry Potter magic. People seem to either have a touch for troubleshooting and figuring things out, or they don't. And it's almost like sales to some extent. Either a natural born salesperson or you're not. And I think that's some very important component of that. And then how do you teach on top of that? And I don't know anyone's really really worked on it very well, especially in a formal setting, especially in modern times. I mean, John's doing great stuff, more about incident and communication and also root cause. And how do you dig into that? How do you apply that stuff? I still don't know.
Yeah. Have you seen Brendan Gregg's use model, USC?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And as part of Golden Signals things, you mean?
Yeah. So Brendan Gregg has the use model, utilization, saturation, and errors, and he uses it for performance troubleshooting. But it's a very low-level sort of thing. For his model, it's not like I'm checking the rate of requests coming into a web server or an entire tier of web servers. Instead, it's what's the utilization on this particular core? Or what's the current memory utilization across this particular bus? So it's very low level stuff, but it's meant for a troubleshooting approach.
Right. And I think that you're right. That's Golden Signals in the larger sense. So I wrote a whole series of articles about Golden Signals. Mm-hmm. Picking up Brendan's stuff and some of the others in the same way, in part because that all sounds excellent. My whole focus was, how do you get that data out of the system?
Right.
Everybody talks about it. No one talks about how do you actually get this stuff. So I wrote a bunch of stuff about that on Medium. But exactly that. So definitely, and I think that applies across a lot of things. That's relatively new for us sort of here, and I think new more broadly. We've actually made a migration of a lot of things over to sort of Golden Signals, whether it's use or one of the other models, kind of to get red models also.
Yep.
you know, together on error rates, and especially latency, of course. Latency is the big one to track there, and errors and so on. So we're trying to do much more of that. The challenge, of course, is still what do you do with it? But particularly in the microservices world, you know, that's where this really becomes important because, you know, we have customers with dozens of microsystems. Every one of them, it looks okay. Monitoring is beautiful. There's no errors, no nothing, but the system's down. And we can't figure out why. And again, it's changing the all worst. The time. Yeah, exactly. But it's sort of the canonical problem. Or the system's slow, even worse, right? And you can't figure out why. And it used to be you kind of had one or two or three tiers. You could figure it out. Now you've got 25 tiers, and they all talk to each other. And you have third-party services, and you've got, you know, RDS and cloud services. That's becoming common everywhere. And I don't think anybody's figured out how to properly troubleshoot and diagnose this. Certainly Honeycomb and so on is looking at that on the observability side, and then, you know, some of the better monitoring, starting to look at all the golden signals if you can get the data. Mm-hmm. Because if you can, then, of course, you know, the use stuff, utilization, the saturation, particularly the latency, usually shows up as a huge red flag right in the middle of that. But you've got to get that data, and you've got to have it organized, and you've got to understand how all these pieces, you know, communicate, which nobody seems to bother to ever document.
That's a super interesting point, because even in Brendan's documentation about how to use his use model, he actually says there are some metrics that there's just no easy way to get them. Circonis has done a lot of work with this too, and like there are entire facets of these low-level metrics that it's just not easy to measure.
Well, exactly. In fact, here's a simple one, and even out of Brendan's stuff, right? His BPS stuff helps some, but that's not simple. Is how do you get Linux CPU run queues?
Right.
You get the load average. You cannot get the run queue other than instantaneous. And every tool that exists, because I checked every single one of them, I wrote one actually, because every single tool out there gives you instantaneous run queue. So how do I know how busy my CPU is on Linux? You can't get it. You can't get the saturation. And so I wrote a little Go program that linked out of my articles that actually samples it. All you can get, the kernel can't give it to you over time. I sample it like every 10 milliseconds for, you know, a few seconds and try to come up with an average to say, this is the current run queue. And of course, as we know, when the queues, you know, fill up whenever, then you're really saturated, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to get that in the kernel, right? The kernel has a very nice load average, but that's not the run queue. We need to have the kernel also give you the run queue. I'm not, unfortunately, a good enough kernel developer to put that in there, but somebody should. And then we'd have that, right? And it would be super useful because when the CPU run queue is more than the number of CPUs or whatever, you're saturated, cut and dried.
Yep.
And everything else doesn't matter anymore. And I think, you know, Brendan's doing some of that stuff at BPF and so on, but we need it. We need it more broadly. I did a whole bunch of work about how do you get that out of Apache logs? Not saturation, but how do you pull latency? How do you get web server latency? That stuff's really hard to get. Load balancers, new AWS ALBs, I should give it to you pretty nicely. HAProxy kind of gives it to you. But you got to hunt all this stuff down. The average developer, you know, sort of person isn't doing this stuff. We need more work pulling this stuff out.
There's a new HTTP standard that the W3C is currently working on. I believe it's called HTTP check, but it allows you to add in arbitrary metrics, like key value metrics, into an HTTP header, which allows you to do things like how long did this request take and record it in the header and like in the header response. And from there, you can pull it from the browser side, which is super cool. Like, that's awesome. Yeah. I wish we had that, you know, even a couple of years ago. Like, it surprises me that we're only just now getting things like that.
True, and there's no technical barrier. You could have written that yourself 10 years ago, right? Put it in your code. In fact, that made me think, gee, we should put that in our app. we do it, the page loads at the bottom of the page, right? We tell you, it used to be, and Sugar and other tools have done this forever, they tell you at the bottom of the page how long that page took, which is kind of cool. The problem now is everything's API-driven, so you have React or Angular or JS, you know, type stuff. So a page is 100 calls, and that those other missing UI calls are just lost. And that's where sort of the back end, Honeycomb and other systems that are picking out back end events, in theory, are picking some of that stuff up, right? And tagged and so on. But that's all, you know, a lot of moving parts to get all that working, right? And then what do you do with all the data? Still an open question. So. And it doesn't help you with your saturation and so on. Because you still get a problem. Okay, now I have latency here across the board, or I have latency on this type of customer. Now what? And you really got to start digging. And that's where everybody falls off the cliff of no available tools. you know, you start trying to dig through these multi-systems. And, you know, the observability people are really, you know, trying to focus on that. And I think that's going to help, but that's sort of not for the faint of heart in some ways, right? You got to dive in pretty deep and know what's going on. And really, it's pretty cutting edge. I think it's a future in a lot of ways, but we still got to get better at it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been talking a lot about troubleshooting, and it's kind of hard to not think about troubleshooting in terms of monitoring as well. Like, when I talk about use, yes, use is primarily a model for troubleshooting, but it's also a way to work through instrumentation. Golden Signals and Tom Wilkie's RED model is actually even more useful for instrumentation and understanding monitoring. So all that feeds kind of into the topic of observability, which I know you've been talking about quite a bit. And so how do you think about observability in terms of what you're doing in China? Like, are you still working with fairly old tools, or are you working with a lot of newer stuff, kind of a mix?
Well, I think here, observability, however you define it, is still an unknown thing. I mean, first to me, because, well, one of the phrases I like a while ago was, you know, sort of, I monitor you, but you make yourself observable. Mm-hmm. Something I put in an article a while ago, and I think that's actually true in that. And here we're still very much in the monitoring traditional sense, whether it's Zabbix or other traditional things here, Prometheus sometimes, you know, doing traditional black box kind of monitoring, which you're getting some of the golden signals you can get and so on, resources and usual things. The observability, which is sort of I make myself observable, where I'm, you know, emitting, you know, rich events, maybe JSON, maybe structured with some tags, I don't think we've ever seen. It's really, it's still an unheard of or nearly unheard of kind of thing here. And the tool, even if you could do it, the tools aren't here. You know, one of the challenges of the Great Firewall and other things is the vast majority of Western tools, whether it's Datadog or New Relic or, you know, APM tools, monitoring tools, log tools, all that stuff are really not available here. So we're providing some of this stuff for our customers, but a lot of those tools and therefore the thinking around those tools and how you should use them and all this kind of stuff, it's just really not here. And so people don't talk about this stuff very much. It's a few local providers, but it's not the same thing, a little bit of APM. And so in that sense, not mature in a lot of ways. And so people don't really aren't capturing their logs even. So, you know, step one is what? Step one is getting your logs off the server, putting them someplace you can look at, whether it's, you know, Splunk's too expensive for most people, but at least some sort of, you know, Elk stack, which is not trivial in itself, to any sort of third party, you know, that's step one, right? And that's actually incredibly rare. We have some customers running their own Elk stacks. There's nothing beyond that. And there's just nothing happening beyond that. Any sort of more sophisticated.
Yeah, that's absolutely crazy to me to think, like, so I spend my entire day in monitoring. It's what I do. It's what I know best. But every company I go to, no matter how mature or advanced or not they are, they still have a like giant Splunk cluster or an Out cluster or like a syslog box that just has where logs go to die. But at least they're doing it, which is, that's good in some ways. So it's wild to me that with a market as large as China and with so much technology there, that a lot of these a lot of the tools that we take for granted aren't there. Like, why is that? Why isn't Datadog and New Relic and Dynatrace and all these companies, why aren't they in China?
Well, so there's two problems. One is technical, or let's say distance of firewall and so on. Just that, you know, over the distances and performance and you know, various connectivity issues are one of them that make these things slow. Although some stuff does work, New Relic works and so on. Another one is you really can't sell the Chinese customers without having legal entities here and tax and all that kind of stuff and potentially running inside the Chinese firewall, which has, you know, a lot of other issues. So we help a lot of companies come into China, not technical companies usually, but other companies. And it's, you know, it's a big process. You can run, you can service the UK or Germany from the US with no problem and get paid and do everything. You really can't do that with China. It's another world in a lot of ways. And so, and it's not a focus. All these companies are doing really well in the West and, you know, they carve out a whole other business and whatever. It's just not been any of them have been willing to focus on. You are seeing, you know, HashiCorp and so on be very popular here and starting to push things in, but those are products people can use. So certainly Vagrant and Vault and these things are becoming more popular. that's different than running a, you know, a SaaS service. The sort of foreign SaaS services consumed by the Chinese user is not much.
Gotcha.
For all the reasons that I mentioned. And yeah, I mean, we've had centralized logging since we started the company. It's one of the first things we built 10 years ago. And then gradually added Splunk and ElkStax. We struggled to get people to use it. I mean, they'd much rather SSH to the server and grep the logs, really, because they know how to do it. They understand it. They don't know what that means. Step back and look at multi-stuff. I don't like Kibana anyway, actually. I find it very hard to use, but I think that's part of it, too. I think there's a big usability issue there. But and Splunk's got its own complications. So in some way, it's hard, and we don't have like the sumos and some of the really nice tools to use. So they just SSH and grep the logs, right? I mean, even our team does that. Grep for IPs, grep for agents, grep for this. Try to figure out who's attacking you and block stuff. It's just what people are used to, and that's what they do. And that's kind of where we are. And that's web logs. So now you start having rich, you know, rich application logs and so on. Is a challenge, yeah. Like I said, we have customers with dozens of Java microservices running. I'm pretty sure that customer's not logging that stuff. So I don't know how they troubleshoot it. And
yeah,
it gets worse because that system has, I don't know, like 20 microservices in very nice HA pairs, right? So you have like payment one, payment two, customer one, customer two, and so on. But they don't do the same thing. And sometimes they're not even running. And so like payment one and payment two actually aren't mirrors of each other. They do different things. And that's horrifically confusing.
Right.
You can imagine. And then they, yeah. So yeah, that's our world. But,
Man, that's an absolutely fascinating world.
And so these tools are coming slowly, you know, but we're trying to provide them somewhat with our platform here as we begin to provide more operation stuff and more discoverability and more centralized logging and more golden signals and things like this. And beyond that, it's pretty much a Zabbix world. Zabbix wasn't popular here 5-6 years ago, and suddenly it's everywhere. A little bit of Prometheus, but you really see Zabbix as the primary monitoring system now, I think.
Interesting.
For most people. We love Zabbix. We're huge Zabbix fans. We've known Zabbix forever, but it has its limitations also. It's not very DevOps friendly, in my opinion.
Right. So I ask all my guests for something actionable. Like we've hit on a lot of really interesting topics here, but some of them are kind of like, what is it like on the other side of the world for some of the listeners? So let's bring this to something that we can do today. So for you, when you're thinking about large-scale systems and trying to make things better, is there anything that you would recommend people that they can focus on today or this week to improve their infrastructure?
I think here and sort of in the West, as we talked about, you know, sort of golden signals and basic information like that is probably the single thing that's something we can do, and I think a lot of people can do, because they're extremely useful and they're hard to get and they take real work. But when you have them, they really can help you a lot, especially as you become more dynamic, more multi-service, multi-microservice, serverless, and all this kind of stuff. And as you scale out into lots of different, you know, alleged copies of all the same thing, you really got to know how things are structured, how they're communicating, and how are those communications, you know, error rates, you know, latency, and so on. If we could all get to that, you know, we'd be 80% of the way there, I think, to figuring out a lot of stuff, and almost the rest of it is just added on after that, and debugging hard things and distributed tracing and all that kind of stuff. But those are really esoteric if you really can't look at your database latency or your payment gateway latencies and so on. So I really still focus on the golden signals. That's why we try to spend a lot of time on it and write about it and so on. And that's still the big bang for the buck for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. So Steve, where can people find more about you and your work?
So we have a few things. One, we have our Chinese company. If you want to see more about that, that's called China Net Cloud, is the English name. So it's chinanetcloud.com. We also actually are taking all of our tools and technology and bringing this to the U.S. and launching that in the U.S. next year. That's a product called Siglos, which is Siglos.io. And so that's going to be taking all of our experience and things we've been doing and sort of operations platform, AWS and cloud stuff, and bringing that to the rest of the world. So at Siglos.io, that's going to be in the Bay Area in the spring. And beyond that, I'm on LinkedIn and Medium and Twitter, probably the most important places to find me. So maybe you can have some links
to that. Yeah, good. Those are all be in the show notes. Highly recommend Steve's Twitter account. He writes some fantastic stuff on there. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot, very interesting.
Thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.